Welcome to Anthony Plog on Music. This is Eddie Ludema, the producer of the show. In the bonus room, Daniel Spreadbury talks about the respect and tight-knit nature of his team, many of which worked together since their days at Sibelius, and how he views the success of a product. He discusses balancing priorities while still aiming for the future, and what he thinks about the extremely fast-paced nature of technology and how it might, or might not, affect the industry. He briefly talks about his friendship with the prolific composer Derek Bourgeois, and finally, Daniel and I, at the end, geek out just a little bit about a beloved style of DAW from the 1990s. If you're enjoying these interviews and insights, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and help spread the word.
Create music that moves with Dorico 5, the brand new version of the music notation and composition software from Steinberg. Packed with new features throughout the application, it's the perfect time to update from your current version or to try Dorico for the first time. You can start for free with Dorico SE or Dorico for iPad, which now allow projects with up to 8 players. Or step up to Dorico Elements, which now allows projects of unlimited size and features an expanded engrave mode. For professional use, choose Dorico Pro, which has many unique features you won't find in any other software. Visit www.steinberg.net/Dorico today and make more time for music.
One thing you've talked about several times, or that you've mentioned several times, is the closeness of your team, how your friends and all of that. And I wonder about this. It's sort of a cliche of a business that starts out like yours, that starts out small or smallish and grows and becomes incredibly big, and they sort of lose the mission statement and it expands and it becomes a huge corporation. Is that a concern of yours, that Dorico is going to be so popular that you'll have to add a lot of people to your staff, and that you may lose that, I guess you would say, precious thing that you have right now?
I mean, it would, in a way, it would be a nice problem to have, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
it would be lovely. I mean, it's not really something that I worry about, to be honest. I think that we're very fortunate that we're still sort of in the sort of fairly nurturing environment of Steinberg. You know, Steinberg is not itself a massive company. I think there are 200 employees at Steinberg, basically. When we joined, I think it was about 120. So it's grown quite a bit in the 10 years that we've been at the company. But, you know, it hasn't grown as fast as some of our peers have. You know, companies like, some of my colleagues went off into other bits of the music technology world after we sort of parted company at Avid. So, for example, my friend Tim, who now works at Native Instruments, that company is much, much bigger than it was 10 years ago when he joined. And I think that then there is a challenge because, of course, how has the growth happened? You know, in the case of Native, yeah, they made amazing products and they really churned out a huge number of these incredible products across all manner of different sort of domains. But they also took money, you know, and so then that comes with a whole load of other challenges. You know, when you take investment money from different sorts of investors, and that comes with its own challenges, you know. And because Steinberg is part of Yamaha is obviously the world's biggest music company, but it's also it's a company that is run with the long term in mind. And I think that's a really good environment to be building a business in, because, you know, Yamaha's 125 years old or something now, I think, or maybe a little bit more. And it's still very much about the craft of making these instruments. And, you know, yes, I mean, it also builds toilets and motorbikes and goodness knows what else. But, you know, Yamaha at its core is an instrument company, and that's about tradition. It's about craft. And it's about, you know, a piano is going to be more or less the same in 5 years as it is today. I'm sure they'll have better woods and better strings and, you know, all the rest of it, but it's ostensibly the same sort of thing. And so we're also encouraged to think in a longer term way at Steinberg. So, you know, we're not, certainly in the latter days of my time at Avid, it was very much driven by the short term, quarter to quarter. You know, if we don't make this number in this quarter, there's going to be more layoffs next quarter. It was that kind of thing. And Steinberg is not run that way, and Yamaha is not run that way.
Yeah, that's great.
And so I think that, you know, because the company isn't about the big bang, it's about growing. You know, I remember when I first met Ralph, who is the director of engineering at Steinberg, his first question to me is, what do you want to be doing at Steinberg in 10 years? Not what do I want to be doing at 10 years, what do I want to be doing at Steinberg in 10 years? And that's because they want people to come to Steinberg and do their their best work there. They want to come and do the thing that, you know, lights them up and that ignites their passion. And, you know, we're very lucky that the engineering staff we have at Steinberg is full of people who are totally passionate about what they're building. And with the right kind of support in place, Steinberg has nurtured Cubase, which is 30 years old plus. That software continues to advance. I really, really hope that we'll be celebrating Dorico's 30th birthday in 24 years or whatever it'll be. I might not be there to see it, although possibly I will be, but I really, really hope that that's what will happen. And I think because of the kind of environment that Steinberg is, there's a very real chance that can happen, because the company takes that long-term view and is encouraged to take that long-term view by our corporate parent.
Eddie and I were talking earlier, just before you came on, about the future of Steinberg, and you want of Dorico. And Eddie, do you want to ask the question about that?
Yeah. So I don't remember where I was reading it when I was first deciding whether or not I should try Dorico. That one of the philosophies behind it, maybe not philosophy, was that technology is advanced. That Finale was made during a certain generation of computers technology. They were limited with certain things, and so the user interface was developed in a certain way, whatever. Same with Sibelius, computers of the 90s. And developed in a certain way. Now with Dorico, they can see everything in hindsight, how technology has evolved. Let's take advantage of what we have now. In 10 years, with quantum computing and even more AI, I know there's already AI in the engine, which is awesome, but technology in 10 years, can you guys see what's going to happen? Some forecasting of how it might evolve?
Yeah, I mean, we can't really see what's going to happen, of course. I don't think anybody really can. And I think even if you'd told me even, you know, a year ago, so, you know, imagine where we were last July before we all saw what ChatGPT could do. It's sort of hard to, it's really, really hard to predict that when these sort of seismic changes happen, they are quite hard to predict for the layman, I think. And I think when it comes to the broader world of technology and how computers are going to develop, I think we are laymen to a degree. You know, as I said earlier on, we play a part in our little industry and we shape it to some degree. But we're also absolutely, because music is such a tiny, tiny part of the overall world in every sense, but certainly in terms of the technology world, you know, very few of, you know, your Apples and your Microsofts are not out there typically thinking about the musician when they're designing their new products and technologies and so on. And so we take advantage of the things that are available to us as best we can. But I think, you know, yeah, it's very hard to predict to what extent will machine learning, you know, what aspects of what we're doing today will be things that machine learning can help us to do. You know, there's really, really interesting research going on into, you know, certainly music generation in terms of shortening pieces, lengthening pieces, taking this melody and doing it in this other style and so on. But nothing that necessarily seems to really support the composer as yet. It's more like, how does somebody who doesn't have the skills that a composer has, how do they do something? And I think what's going to be really fascinating is to see, how does this technology actually support, you know, so Dorico doesn't really have any artificial intelligence in it in the way that we decide, you know, would describe today ChatGPT or Midjourney or anything like that. Dorico is more like in the old-fashioned way of AI, which is like an expert system where human creators have designed algorithms that work together in order to get to a particular result. You know, to what extent will machine learning be able to improve or complement what we're working on? You know, these are things that we're certainly thinking about and doing some work on. But it's very, very hard to say exactly what that's going to look like. I mean, I think certainly what I would hope that we will do is, as we've always been, sort of best foot forward when it comes to embracing technological change, maybe not always as quickly as we would like, because I think one of the big challenges when you're working on a big product like Dorico with a small number of people is that you've got to take your sort of prioritization very seriously, because obviously you know anything that you do today is a thousand or an infinite number of things that you can't do today. There's an opportunity cost involved in, you know, every decision that we all make in all of our everyday lives, when we decide to learn this rather than learning that, or go for this dinner rather than not that dinner. You know, we're shutting off a whole load of possibilities to ourselves. And so we have to be very careful about how we balance our investment in the future versus our investment in what customers are going to benefit from today and tomorrow. And so it's Yeah, I wouldn't want to speculate, to be honest, about where we might be in 10 years. As I say, I very much hope the Dorica will still be playing a very significant role in the lives of musicians. I hope it won't be that everything has changed to such a degree that, you know, even the whole notion of having software like Dorica won't need to be there anymore. I really do like to think that as long as there will be groups of humans coming together to play on, you know, maybe they'll be electronic, but instruments that they are playing physically themselves, and they're playing music that is complex enough that they can't remember it all off the tops of their heads, that needs some kind of centralized coordination, that there will be the need for music notation and for people to take the care to make that notation as clear as they can and to communicate as well as they can what the intention behind it is. And as long as that intention is there, and as long as that need is there, then software like Dorica needs to be there, and we will try to do our best to respond to the changing times and tides. But to meet that fundamental need, doesn't matter what technology it's been, whether it's been recorded sound or doesn't matter, people still want to get together and play music in real life. And I hope that that won't go away just because robots can do it better than we can, or quicker than we can, or more creatively than we can, in for some value of creativity. You know, I hope that we'll still value good old fashioned human creativity. I mean, I even heard one report that suggested that maybe we might even value human creativity even more once we are in a world where anything can be created by anything, you know, instantly, that maybe actually something that then becomes artisanal, that is actually made by humans rather than made by machine learning. So we'll just have to wait and see, but it's something that is fascinating to be part of, just like all of the other interesting huge seismic shifts in technology, like computers moving into the home and the internet, and now mobile devices in our pockets more powerful than we could ever imagine, and now machine learning, you know, these things happening all within my memory, not only my lifetime but within my memory, is just incredible. And you know, I hope to goodness that I will have several more decades left on this planet to see what else might happen. If you sort of imagine that where we were in 1980 when we first got that computer in my brother's bedroom to where we are today in 2023, and then try to extrapolate, it's impossible. It's impossible.
You know, there was a very interesting article on AI written by Jan Swofford. He was asked to write an article. Jan Swofford is a biographer who's written biographies of Brahms, Mozart, Beethoven, and Ives. And philosophically, he was arguing against a certain type of AI, and he said, imagine, like, if you take baseball, which of course is not an English sport, but if somebody makes a great throw from center field, it's exciting. He said a robot can do that every time.
Every time. That's
and
right.
That's what makes it not exciting. Yes. And I think in terms of music, you go to a concert and you never know if somebody's going to make a mistake or not.
Or just that the interpretation is going to knock your socks off in a way that you hear a piece that you know really well, but interpreted in a really exciting new way.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And though that's lightning in a bottle, and
yeah,
you know, yes, a robot could give you 100 versions of the slow movement of Beethoven 7, one of my favorite symphonic movements, but would any of them be as good as the one on Carlos Kleiber's CD? I doubt it, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I just think that's what we need to cling to, that we still have, us silly meatbags, us humans, we still can do things that are amazing and unique and remarkable, and that there's value in that.
Yeah.
In their uniqueness and in their, you know, even in their remarkably mundaneness, they can still be amazing and fascinating.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Tony, wasn't it Hoken when we interviewed Hoken Hardenberger, where he said that I don't remember who he was quoting, but that the beauty is found in the blemishes or
in the
flaws.
Imperfections.
Imperfections.
The beauty is found in the imperfections. Yeah.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
There's so many. It's interesting for me doing this podcast how so many things hook together. And one of the things you were talking about earlier, that you felt like late at night you were going to have to answer somebody in Los Angeles or in Australia or something. Just recently, we interviewed Jörg Widmann, the great clarinetist and composer. And he will get on a composing project and he just won't let go. And he said there are times when he goes to bed and he tries to sleep and he said, the basses are calling to me. and that's exactly like you, it sounds like to me.
One of my great friends that I had the privilege of knowing over many years working at Sibelius and then on Dorico was the composer Derek Bourgeois.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Very fine composer for brass. I'm sure you know his work very well. And he was amazing to me. He sadly died, probably 7 or 8 years ago now. I saw him, you know, not long before he died. And I went to his home when he was sort of convalescing through some of the treatments he was having at the time. But what was amazing to me about Derek is that he is one of those composers for whom the music just literally flows out of him like turning on a tap. He would come down every morning, have his morning coffee or tea. I can't remember what he said he used to drink, but he would literally sit down at Sibelius and then at Dorico in the end, which he was using at the time that he passed away. He would play back the last 6 or 7 bars of the music that he'd written at the end of the previous day's composing session, and then the music would just keep playing in his head. And I thought, what an amazing thing that was, that his musical creativity was so free and so like a piano roll in his head, basically, that all he had to do was just capture it and put it down. And, you know, I'm not a composer, really. I do a bit of writing for my choirs from time to time, but it's never been like that for me. You know, it's never been like I already know what the music is and it's just coming out of me. And I sat there one morning. You know, I used to go and see certain composers and watch them work, and it would be quite an interesting way of learning about the things that they were doing, spending a lot of time doing, just sitting behind somebody and occasionally ask them, why did you do just that just then? You know, it can be quite interesting. And Derek was a formidable gentleman, and he didn't used to take any rubbish about anything. But just watching him work was an incredible privilege because, like you say, the basses were calling to him. He already knew it. It was already there when he sat down at the computer. And it was really, I sort of am envious of that, to be honest. Because nothing I've ever done musically has flowed as freely as it appeared that Derek was just able to literally, it just came out of his brain and into his fingers. And when the software is working well, the software gets out of the way of enough that it doesn't prevent him from it just flowing into the computer. And a remarkable man. You know, he wrote more symphonies, I think, than any other British composer in the end, but so few of them have ever been performed. He was working on 116th symphony, I believe, at the time of his passing, and they're all pretty remarkable works. I mean, if you're familiar with his brass works, you know that he loved a good pun, he loved some wordplay. Mm-hmm. And he was his music is very witty, and his symphonies are, again, I've obviously heard many of them only played back by Sibelius rather than by any real musicians. But his endlessly inventive and, you know, intricate, just wonderful. I was so fortunate to spend time with him and his wife in the latter years of his life. And, you know, I was just talking to my colleague James today, whose son is learning trombone. And, you know, he went off to the music shop at the Barbican and picked up 2 or 3 more pieces of Derek Bourgeois' stuff. So, you know, it's very, very often played still, but I miss Derek. He was excellent value, and what a titanic sort of musical mind, just the creativity that would pour off him was just absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, I think very few people have that kind of talent where they just think it and it goes.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
Well, boy, this has really been fun. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk tonight.
It's been my absolute pleasure.
Yeah, and Eddie, anything you'd like to add?
No.
That sounds like yes.
Yes. Yeah, no, you guys are geniuses. I mean, this has been really fun. It's really interesting.
I love this story. Do you know the name Calvin Coolidge?
I do, yes.
Yeah, the president of the United States. President, and his nickname was Silent Cal because he hardly spoke at all.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and evidently he was at some party and he was wedged in between two women, two very talkative women. And this was, you know, back in the 1920s, so $5 back then was a lot of money. And one of the women said to him, she said, I bet my friend $5 that I could get you to say at least 3 words tonight. And he looked at her and he said, you lose. So so that's Eddie.
That's Eddie, me.
Eddie's our silent Cal tonight.
Well, I do want to geek out about code stuff, but another day.
Yeah, well, I'd be happy to, Eddie. That'd be fun.
It's just fascinating. It's just, it's fun. It's fun to hear your background and fun to see, you know, where Dorico's come from and where it's going. It's really cool. Gen Xers unite. Atari Absolutely. 800, Commodore, you know, it's okay. We were competitive back then, but...
Yeah, sure. It's all good.
We can all
get on and enjoy that stuff now.
That's right.
The things that I watch on YouTube these days are basically choirs, cricket highlights. I'm afraid it's cricket for me, not baseball. And retro computing videos. I just
there you
spend
go.
My
yep,
life
right.
watching... You know, men of my age and older using computers that I used when I was a kid and, you know, being fascinated by them.
You know what's interesting? Sorry, this is something I'm going to say. So
okay, here we go. Geek out.
Here we go. Geek out just a little bit. So I was teaching a trumpet lesson to one of our commercial music students, freshmen, and we were working on some stuff in Ableton, just showing in a couple things, whatever. And he asked me, he said, hey, have you ever heard of trackers before? Have you gone down trackers thing? I'm like, what are you talking about? I didn't know what he's talking about. And so he sent me a link to a YouTube video. I go home, I watch this video, and it was like watching my teenage years.
Yeah.
It was strange. I thought, I used to do this stuff in the 90s, the demo scene. And so I ended up getting a tracker because I used to use one in the 90s to try to make some video game music, whatever. But it's really interesting to see the generation now that is coming into college that they are going to what we would say retro or classic, I guess, legendary.
Yeah.
they love this stuff and how it's coming back. It's interesting to see how things cycle, you know, the waves and trends. It's fun.
I was rubbish with trackers. I tried so hard to make
good-sounding
songs. And I would, you know, the main thing about a tracker was that you could take any mod file and you could see exactly what made it tick. But even though you could, it's, you know, like studying a score, like studying an orchestration, you can see exactly how it works. But that isn't enough if you haven't got that spark, that, you know, that sort of that talent, I suppose, in the end, I didn't have to do it. You know, I could pick apart exactly how this bass line is interleaved with the drums because you only had four voices to play with and all the rest of it. But because I couldn't, I didn't have the skills. I couldn't actually do anything good with it. But boy, did I try when I was a teenager on my Amiga in Octomed and so on. Yeah, that was great.
Yep, I was in the same boat. Yep, it looked really cool. And what I still love to do is pull up the demos because, you know, they come with demo files. And you pull up the demos and you play them at high speed and you see all the numbers and the note names flashing by and you have these students walk by or professors walk by. What is that?
Yeah.
It looks cool, huh? I can't do it, but it looks cool.
Yeah. And again, it's like an old player piano.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it's another tool.
Just another player piano, but, you know, but able to trickle samples rather than just hit the hammers. But it's fantastic.
And what I have to figure out is how to work my tracker VST into Dorico somehow. We're going to plug these together.
Yeah, I think with at least basic, as long as you don't want to change tempo, it'll probably work. Because that's the thing where the tempo sync doesn't work if you change the tempo. But trackers, you would very rarely change the tempo in a song anyway. So
yeah, that's true.
That's okay. Just 120, four on the floor. That's what we're after.
That's right. That's right. All right. I'm inspired,
that Euro,
Daniel.
That Euro dance sound is what we're after. It's got to be that 90s rave music is basically what we're talking about.
Yep, that's what we're going for. All right, Tony. That's all I've got.
Okay. Well, thanks, Daniel. Great to see you.
My pleasure.